So, James, we are back once again to pluck mirth from the macabre and find fun at funerals in another episode of The Way They Went. And this, James, these recordings are all about looking past the tragic demise of a treasured icon and exploring gallows humour and what it is about, sometimes about the circumstances of somebody passing away, that is amusing, that amuses us, or that there is comedy that can be brought forth from the tragedy. And I think that's, you know, that's the journey that we're on. This week, however, I'm going to lead us a little bit away from that formula. I mean, some people might describe it as a mean-spirited sneer at the way someone famous passed away. I would describe our recordings as affectionate and sensitive recountings of career highlights, some of our most, you know, famous stars and the obscure weirdos that you bring to the table. But I mention this because our next investigation today covers a genuinely tragic death. You know, it's a really awful tragedy. There's nothing inherently amusing about the event in itself and the life that was sadly lost. Let's just, you know, get those cards on the table straight away. We have to dig around in the aftermath of the death to uncover the comedy behind the coffin. Whether we succeed in this, we'll have to see, but we will get to that.
And these are, I think, these are loving explorations, aren't they? These are people that we have affectionately, not just quickly found stuff about on the internet, but we've spent a lot of time, you know, honing their story and looking at really, I suppose, the inspirational essence of their life, not just, you know, a cheap laugh for a low budget, in fact, no budget podcast.
Yeah, let's say that. Let me start then this morning with getting you, as is usually the case, to guess the subject of my research. So today's subject is a lady. I guess you might need a bit more than that before hazarding a guess.
I think I know what one of those is based on some of the books that you've lent me, but I need a bit more information.
We both met one once. Okay, so born in Los Angeles, California in 1926. Her real name was N.J. Mortensen. Now, a real fan would get it from that. Any thoughts?
I've got no idea. I was thinking maybe we're talking about an actress of some kind.
Correct. This is an actress. I'll pile on some heavier clues now. The N and J stood for Norma Jean.
Now, I'm a bit closer now because, as you know, I'm a big fan of Elton John when I can get hold of his material. And I think he might have recorded a song once, which, of course, lost significance because of Princess Dido's death, which I think it was used for. Are we in Monroe territory? Is that where we are?
Yes, indeed. Well done. I knew you'd get it from that. I hoped you would anyway, because of your massive Elton John, you know, fanship. Norma Jean Baker. She was at Norma Jean Mortensen. She was born. Marilyn Monroe. She became the biggest film star in the world in the 1950s, pretty much, starring as the archetypal blonde bombshell in huge hit movies, including Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, How to Marry a Millionaire, Bus Stop, 7 Year Itch, Prince and the Showgirl, Some Like It Hot, and of course, Police Academy 5, Assignment Miami Beach.
I don't remember that one. Was she Lassard in that one?
That may be an error. So, yeah, I mean, look, we don't need to go into the life history in any great detail, particularly when talking about Marilyn Monroe. I think most people have got a pretty good idea as to who she was. Megastar actress, singer, sort of, and sex symbol. So she had a glittering movie career, but also a very troubled private life. And the circumstances of her death are absolutely tragic. You know, I mean, in short, she committed suicide by drug overdose. An awful outcome. You know, there's no argument about that. And I want to be absolutely clear. There's no suggestion of poking fun at that. It's absolutely tragic.
I'm just thinking people listening will try and relate Marilyn Monroe to a modern day superstar just to get a sense of the kind of person she was or that she's like. And I'm thinking for me personally, I think she's somewhere between Letitia Dean and Lady Gaga.
I think, James, the best thing to do is to just very briefly describe the demise. The facts are relatively simple. I'm going to take you back to the evening of Saturday, 4th of August, 1962, Brentwood, Los Angeles. And this is the sort of widely reported account. She was at home with her housekeeper and had gone to bed. The housekeeper noticed the bedroom light was still on at 3:30 a.m., which was very unusual. She was worried. The door was locked. All very odd. She called Monroe's therapist, Dr. Greenson, Ralph Greenson. He lived nearby. He arrived a few minutes later, peered in from the sort of from outside into the bedroom, could see kind of in that she was in there but not moving. He broke a pane of glass and sort of opened the window, climbed in to find her dead in bed, essentially. He then called her personal doctor, another doctor, Dr. Engelberg, who arrived shortly afterwards, and Engelberg pronounced her dead at the scene and called the police. She was found, you know, nude in bed, lying face down, an empty pill bottle at hand from a two-day-old prescription for Nembutal, which would have had about 50 pills inside. The bottle was empty. Police arrived about 4:30 a.m., found nothing amiss that would indicate a crime, you know, no evidence of a break-in or struggle or anything like that. And they were satisfied with the housekeeper and the two doctors' accounts of what they had found. The coroner concluded the cause of death as acute barbiturate poisoning, ingestion of overdose, and probable suicide. So no suggestion on the facts that this was anything other than completely tragic and awful. And she was only 36 years old. 36. Awful. So we need to lighten the mood. My angle on this, James, is that we only need a very slight left turn to uncover the amusement here, if amusement is the right word, which arises from the abundance of conspiracy theories about this tragic event, which rely on some of the most astonishing wild conjecture you will ever hear. And we have briefly touched on conspiracy theories before in some of our earlier scientific investigations. And actually, James, I think you have added a number of fairly preposterous conspiracy theories of your own onto the pile. And maybe you'll add some more shortly. Who knows? So please do have a think about anything you'd like to add to the genre. But the first thing to say about conspiracy theories in general, for me, is to repeat what David Padil said about them, which is that the reason they're so popular is because they allow idiots to feel like intellectuals. I think that's right. Do you agree with that observation on conspiracy theories?
Well, I have to say first and foremost that I probably put myself in a bracket of being an alternate realist. Therefore, because I'm quite susceptible and predominantly, well, I'm lightly educated and naive, I am therefore a perfect channel for alternative explanations of history and facts. So I think it's important to say that. And I think sometimes people of my ilk do feel a little put upon that we can't put out there, you know, the most outrageous and ridiculous ideas about things that are clearly established by scientific evidence.
See, it's interesting. Yes. I mean, in this recording, we're going to encounter the difference between feelings and facts. So, you know, a conspiracy theorist might well say, I just don't feel that's true. It's neither here nor there how you feel about a fact. You know, a fact is a fact. It's a self-established set of circumstances that are true. It's not some, you know, there's no point saying, I don't feel that water freezes at 0 degrees Celsius. It doesn't matter what you feel about it. Either it does or it doesn't, you know. Do you know what I mean? So it's interesting.
I mean, I think there are counter arguments around that, though. You know, so for example, I have very strong feelings about facts that I don't like, you know. So what that leads me to then is to challenge those facts, even though clearly I don't have anything, you know, or any sort of credible alternative to bring to the table. I feel that I should be challenging it.
Yes, I think, I mean, as we will come to learn shortly, you would be the ideal candidate to write a book about the death of Marilyn Monroe and to propose some alternative facts based on your feelings around the event. And that's pretty much the sort of modus operandi that a lot of journalists and writers, you know, loosely described, have used in putting some of their books together. So, I mean, look, we're going to go through some of these conspiracy theories because they are worth review. If for nothing else than to poke fun at them. And there's two ways to think about conspiracy theories that have emerged around Marilyn Monroe's death. Firstly, you could think of them as valid, insightful exploration of the dubious motives or even the hideous crimes of shady figures around her that have got something to hide. That's kind of one approach you could adopt when thinking about them. The other is that they're a pathetic load of bollocks that have been clumsily tacked onto this tragic event, mainly by a series of opportunistic chancers whose only motivation is to cash in on the awful tragedy of a famous and well-loved public figure with their squalid little books and articles, which are little more than literary toilet paper.
There may be a midpoint there, just to stop you. There may be a midpoint between those two categories, which I'm going to really call, I suppose, it's quite narrow and narrow-minded as well as anything else. I'm going to call Daily Express. There is a fine line between those two categories, I think.
Yes, in between, I guess you could insert just any copy that's sensationalist, anything that will sort of imply there is something more to the event, or that there's something lurid that we ought to be, you know, ought to think about. But look, you'll have to make up your own mind on this. You know, we, as ever, true scientists, will remain models of neutrality. As always, this is just an absolutely neutral presentation of the facts. So let's start with bullshit theory number one. Theory number one, she was murdered to hush up an affair or an alleged affair with President Kennedy and or Robert F. Kennedy, the president's brother. So that's kind of theory number one. And there's a couple of variations on this, which I'll come on to. Now, as with a lot of these theories, there's kind of like half a grain of truth, and it's sort of tiny thread running through it somewhere, which may have a, you know, a sort of ring of something true about it. And, you know, she may well have had an affair with one or both of the Kennedys. It's kind of accepted that she had some sort of relationship, sexual relationship, with President Kennedy, who himself was, you know, a notorious womanizer and married and Catholic. So the idea in this theory is that she was murdered and it was a fake suicide because the affair could have been embarrassing to the president in some way. The slight drawback on this theory is there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that that is the case. So that's theory number one. Any thoughts on that?
I think there are, in what you've presented and what you've put across, there are some glaringly obvious facts that we can draw from, you know, and we should make assertions, and we should be, you know, free. I'm going to use the word free to think broadly around bits of evidence you've presented. And really, what I'm going to try and do is extrapolate things from some of them. So, firstly, she was in bed, which I think leads to a suggestion of naughtiness. Let's put that out there. And secondly, I think importantly, you mentioned she was naked. She didn't have any clothes on. Again, that is making a number of suggestions about her lifestyle and her approach to things. Now, thirdly, and most importantly, and I think maybe this is some unconscious bias on your behalf, you used the word peeped when you suggested that the doctor peeped in on her. Again, you know, there is there's an underlying wave here that suggests that infidelity was something that she had for breakfast, and that JFK had indeed been hiding in her wardrobe.
I'm not sure I did use the word peeped, but even if I did, I mean, okay, so you can chalk that one up to the Daily Express sort of approach. I mean, if you were going to murder her and fake a suicide in order to sort of cover up the fact that that she'd had an affair with President Kennedy, would he have been in the wardrobe at the time of the murder? I mean, it strikes me that that is a slight weak point in the strategy to cover this up, having the president himself, you know, 3,000 miles away from where he should have been in Washington.
This takes me back to the Sherlock Holmes theory, though. You know, kind of, if you present the least expected thing prominently and obviously, it's therefore true that the underlying obviousity is not, in fact, the truth. Remember that? That was a quite famous quote, I think.
Yeah, you've repeated that, you know, verbatim. That's astonishing. I don't know how you do it. Let's move on to theory number two. This is a variation on number one, which emerged in the 70s. And by the way, there were none of these theories came out straight after the death. These all came out some years after, when memories could be manipulated, perhaps.
The truth takes time.
Yeah. So this came out in the 70s. Marilyn was supposed to have been murdered by the FBI or possibly the CIA with faked involvement of the president, to use against him for political motives. So, you know, they killed her and then faked Kennedy's involvement at the scene so that they'd have leverage over him and could persuade him to do what they wanted. Again, there's absolutely no evidence for this at all.
I think that's what people actually refer to as the magic wardrobe theory, I think.
Is it? Okay, well, that's a new shorthand for that theory. I was going to say, I mean, this is the point at which, you know, naive clowns, you know, possibly like you, might wheel out the argument, and this is a sort of favourite of the conspiracy theorists, that the fact that there's no evidence indicates that the, you know, the shadowy figures behind the crime did such a good job at hiding the evidence, that in itself is proof that they were, you know, something happened and they were up to no good. You know, the absence of evidence is itself evidence. What do you think of that theory?
I think, as you've quite correctly detected, I put myself in the sort of counter-illusionist bracket, where, again, you know, we take the fragments of what we have and we make something new, we make something different, you know, in the same way that jazz makes a right racket out of what usually is quite melodic tone. I'm not sure about what you've presented, because to me it's too complex, and as you know, I can only handle simple.
Yeah, your brain just can't accept a complex explanation. So, but look, let me put it in this way: the no evidence equals evidence argument. I mean, students of logic would describe this as a circular argument, which is another way of saying it's total bullshit. Okay, so anyway, let's move on. Theory number three. This is yet another variation of Marilyn being murdered. This did not come out until the 80s. And by the way, I'm deliberately not going into book titles or article titles or mentioning the authors of these theories, partly because I haven't read any of them, because I based my own research on publicly available summary accounts on popular websites, newspaper articles, and so on. And partly because, you know, I know, and you know, this podcast will ultimately be going out to tens of millions of people, probably hundreds of millions of people in the next sort of 3 to 6 months. And I want to deny the writers of these theories the oxygen of publicity, given that most of them, frankly, deserve to be buried up to their necks in toxic waste. So, theory number three, another variation on Marilyn being murdered. This one kind of suggests that she died in an ambulance, so a different location of death, on the way to hospital after some kind of psychotic episode that led to her death or suicide. And the body was then returned to her home and set up to look like an accidental overdose, again by the Kennedys and or the FBI or some shadowy agency. Again, there's no evidence of any kind for this. There are no reliable sources for this idea. It seems to be based totally on unfounded speculation of the nastiest kind. So that's number three.
I think just in terms of, you know, you were talking about a kind of logic loop there. I probably should say, to be fair to people listening, that I come at this with a completely blank mind. I haven't sullied my thinking with anything near education or learning. So I want to make that clear.
Very helpful. I think in that way, you represent the average tabloid reader and reader of these books, you know, very accurately. Number four, murdered by the mob. So a book came out in 1982 that she'd been murdered on the orders of union bosses who had been trying to get information out of Marilyn to use against the Kennedys. So using her, sort of, her connection to President Kennedy to get blackmail material, which she refused to provide. So they killed her. I mean, this feels like absolute rubbish to me, to be perfectly honest. And it gets worse, you know. So that's theory number four. Number five, just very briefly, there were yet more books saying that she was murdered. No new evidence, no new witnesses. The books relied on accounts that had already been discredited and witnesses that had already been discredited. There were, you know, a number of pointless rehashings of the same old rubbish. But number six is a new theory, the dodgy doctors. Before I even describe it, do you instinctively think that doctors could have been involved in a crime of this sort?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because, I mean, there's no real sort of historical or modern precedence for someone in a clinical profession being involved in an untoward murder or disappearance. So it is hard to believe, I guess.
You're very nearly playing the shipman card there just to pull the rug from under me, aren't you? Anyway, let's ignore that for now. Dodgy doctors, yeah. So this theory number six, this is the suggestion that her two doctors had made a mistake and had independently prescribed different medications that then clashed with each other and caused her death accidentally. At which point, the two doctors apparently acted out an episode of Murder, She Wrote and faked the death by suicide. It looks like unspeakable nonsense for which there is absolutely no evidence. So that is theory number six.
I think Murder, She Wrote is a powerful sort of narrative and structure to use, actually, when you're trying to analyse something, an event like this, not only that's dated and that people, there's a really kind of murky sort of understanding of now, but the theme tune itself always helps my thinking. When I put Murder, She Wrote on, when I watch the box sets over and over and over and over and over and over, just mainly for Angela Lansbury, but, it is something that helps me at least.
Yes, it's probably an appropriate lens to look at important history and, to analyse what went down. So, yeah, absolutely. The theory number seven, which is the last of the formal theories, and then I've got one of my own to propose. Theory number seven was that she was a revenge murder, basically. She was murdered by the CIA in an act of revenge against President Kennedy, who the CIA blamed for the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, which I know nothing about, to be frank. The CIA blamed Kennedy for mishandling the event, and this was an act of revenge. So this was a theory put forward sort of around 20 years ago or so. A reviewer described this theory as a tissue of conjecture, speculation, and pure fiction presented as documentary fact. So there, an indication there as to the viability of that theory.
I think of all the theories that you've outlined, I think I'm glad that you've kept that one at number seven as the last, really, because for me, that's probably the most credible of all the things. You know, we know, don't we, that at the time, the animal welfare lobby was outraged by the Bay of Pigs invasion. And we know that they were baying for blood, but not in a in a cannibalistic or violent way. I think that nails it. I think that does explain it. I think what you've done there is very cleverly outlined the life and sad demise of a very well-known character. You've outlined it and given us a number of possibilities, but at the end, true to form, you've nailed it.
That's the one, isn't it? Yeah, I can see that's attracted you straight off. I would like to pitch a theory of my own. I think this is kind of almost the only remaining possible explanation to the facts. Which nobody has yet written a book about. And maybe this is my opportunity, you know, for literary stardom. But my theory is that, conspiracy theory, David Icke went back in time, possibly wearing his turquoise shell suit, and he ate Marilyn Monroe. You know, he sort of absorbed her and then returned to 1967, 5 years later, where he used her spiritual powers, you know, sort of internally, to propel himself into his career as a professional goalkeeper for Coventry City. However, and this is the clever bit, right? Listen, get your notebook out. The ghost of Marilyn Monroe inside Icke fought back, and she managed to infect Icke internally with the arthritis that ended his goalkeeping career at the tender age of 21. So there you go. I mean, that, for me, that fully fits all the facts about both the demise of Marilyn Monroe and also the end of David Icke's goalkeeping career, which, you know, both are, you know, equally important and major events in 20th century history. So what do you think of that?
I'm going to have to go back to my coven or my Coventry, as it's known, to check that really with a book that I'm not allowed to mention, but I will very briefly, The Ikean Paradigm, and see if there are chapters in that that perhaps relate to some of the things that you said. But I mean, it's highly possible.
I mean, whether he actually killed her or, you know, and absorbed her sort of post-mortem, or whether the exact circumstances, I don't think we can ever really understand unless he writes a book about it, or you can access the spiritual plane and access the information in that way. I don't think we'll ever quite get to the bottom of all the details, but it strikes me as yet another very, very attractive conspiracy theory about her tragic death. But I think just to kind of draw that to a conclusion, which I think most people would be extremely grateful if we did. In summary, in my opinion, as a neutral observer, you will rarely encounter such a despicable bunch of utterly unprincipled shit stirrers out to sell their pointless, seedy, squalid little books purely to make a few quid for themselves by pissing on the grave of a victim of a great tragedy. That's my summary of the conspiracy theories. In a slight break from tradition, I think that we can conclude that was definitely not the way she went.
Hello, I'm Jack Humphreys.
I'm Danny Danson.
And this time, listener, we're talking about the joys and wonder of camping.
When camping, you only need to take the bare necessities with you. My packing list only includes the old army surplus tent, cricket bat and sleeping bag, machine gun, tuck box, bear traps, clean trousers and trolleys in case of self-shading, and my portable pianoforte for a good old sing-song round the fire.
I love camping, Danny. The stiff canvas drip-drying in the bushes, propping up Uncle Walter near the firkin's dray.
Now, Jackie always brings the food and I look after the drinks. Camping can be thirsty work, so probably best to take a few vats of gin, brandy, cherry brandy, vermouth, slow gin, spare brandy, slow vermouth, Tunisian whiskey for the children, and for the ladies, tequila. And for other provisions, just like mother, bring 5 pounds of snuff and 100 cigarillos per day for each man, woman, and child.
Delicious. And if you get peckish, I always like to take along with me some tinned aubergines, goat's lips, and dried heron. You can smell them cooking as you're trimming your twig with your caribou trusty slicer. I learned these skills at Sir Arthur Bison's Royal Scout Pack. His motto, peel it, sniff it, grease it, flick it. And when you're out in the countryside, berries and fruit can be delicious, but remember, some are very poisonous. So only ingest them in cook's pantry or near the marzipan box in the secondary larder.
Now, Jack, what's the best way to light the old campfire? I like to put down a good layer of kindling. Last time I found some really splendid wooden slats in my butler's camp bed. Went up a treat, especially when I doused it in paraffin from his cooking stove and cleared the smoke with his blanket.
I've had many fabulous camping trips, Danny, to East Rhodesia, the Ottoman coast, and the Zanzibar labour camp. Oh, the memories.
Tell me, Jack, are you bringing your elderly St. Bernard this time? No? Oh, shame.
Above all, Danny, remember the countryside code. Keep your hair tidy, keep your short trousers pressed at all times, and keep the lumpen proletariat off your 200 acres. Remember all those wonderful things for a happy camping trip. That's it for now.
Pip, pip.
So we're going to move now to the next, I suppose, great life, really, that we want to look at, but through the lens of their demise. That's, I suppose, the essence of this show. And I, too, this time have chosen a lady, a woman. OK, so, Dave, you have to familiarise yourself with what that means once more. And I think as I explain some of the elements of this lady, I want you to retain in your mind a key question, okay? And the key question I want you to retain is she dead? Is she really dead? Okay, because essentially, I suppose, we're talking about a potential disappearance rather than a demise in itself, although there are several factors and theories, okay? So we're sort of dangerously in the cold water of conspiracy theory or unknown or unexplained. Okay, so it makes it more exciting, hopefully, as we go on. And this lady that we're talking about was born in 1903. So again, retain that key question. She was born in Hull, in Kingston upon Hull, which, if people don't know, is a bit like Coventry by the seaside. By trade, if you like, in terms of her study and her work, she gained a degree in economics from Sheffield University. So she's a kind of economist, I think, in her time. You know, economics was, I suppose, the thing that fired her up in terms of her academic pursuit. But there was another significant activity that I think really is what we best know her for and that defined her life. And I think once I start to explain some of this, you will get a good sense of who this person is. Okay, so we know that the first famous machine that she operated and articulated for a great triumph, again, I'm trying to skirt around who this is, her first great machine was called Jason. Okay, so it wasn't a robot or anything like that. It was a machine that she used to make a great adventure, a great travel with that machine. So we're getting a little bit nearer to who it is now. And any initial thoughts, Dave, on what I'm presenting?
No. I mean, this is straight out of your classic sort of archive of people that Dave's never heard of. I mean, born in 1903 in Hull, and you set off by saying is she really dead or did she disappear? If she did disappear and not die, then she'd be approaching sort of 118 years of age. So I think it's kind of all, it's pretty likely that she has died. I have no idea who this is. Please carry on with your great clues.
Okay, so in 1929, a significant thing happened for this lady. She gained her pilot's license. Okay, she became a qualified pilot, or at least she had a license to attempt to fly an aeroplane. And now that is, I think, the key fact here. You know, apart from the fact that she could now, if she is alive still, she could be 118 out there. She started flying and she got involved in a number of, I suppose, fairly adventurous and fairly ambitious challenges at the time. So in 1930, she was the first woman to fly solo from England to Australia, and it took her around about 19 days from the 5th of May to the 24th of May. That's 11,000 miles. Now, why she didn't just go Qantas, I don't know, because, you know, obviously you get a meal and there's movies and all those kind of things, but she decided to do it solo, and she was successful, so successful, in fact, that she was given a CBE in George V's 1930 birthday honours list. So a real accolade for all that hard work that she'd done, taking to the skies, going half a world away. She got a badge from the King, which I think, you know, it's quite an important thing, really. And this was the start of a number of adventures and activities, which included in 1933, she flew nonstop from South Wales to North Wales. No, sorry, it's from South Wales to New York. But she unfortunately didn't quite make it to New York and crashed somewhere in Connecticut. But she was okay. The plane, I think, was ruined. But I think with a soldering iron and some duct tape, she managed to fix that. And in the year preceding this, she got married. That's not a sort of, a surprising thing. But the surprising factor of this is the man that she married, another pilot, Jim Mollinson, he proposed to her after only 8 hours of meeting her. Okay, so she was a pretty special lady there. So let's just talk about one more of these flights. And then, Dave, we'll see if you're a bit closer to who this wonderful person was. In 1936, she flew from Gravesend Airport to South Africa, and that was her last kind of record-breaking flight that she undertook successfully. So any ideas?
Famous 20th century female aviator. I mean, you know, there's so many names on that list, it's hard to know which one to pick. I don't know who it is. I've got the word, I mean, this is a bit embarrassing, I probably should know. Was it some Amy Deerhart or Emily Deerhart or something like that? Or am I going, is that totally barking up the wrong tree?
You're very, very close. Okay, so I'll tell you a little bit more and then I'll go to the reveal. You got one of the first names, Amy, you got right. Okay, so I'll tell you a little bit more about Amy. In 1934, she became the youngest president the Women's Engineering Society. Okay, quite an accolade, I think, at the time. Really, I suppose we need to give her a fuller picture of her life and to tell you a little bit more about who we're talking about. We need to look at the events of World War II. So we won't talk about all the strategic alliances that fell apart and countries declaring war on each other. And, you know, we won't go through the full history of World War II because we probably need, I don't know, probably 2, maybe 3 hours on that one, because, you know, that could be another podcast for us. But in World War II, she joined the Air Transport Auxiliary, the ATA, okay, in 1941. She joined officially. In 1941, she, on the 5th of January, very early on, she was flying from Prestwick in Scotland to Kidlington near Oxford. Now, Prestwick is an important place that I want you to take on board again, Dave. So again, you're retaining this question, is she still alive? I think that's important. But Prestwick as a place, does that say anything else to you?
The only thing I know about Prestwick, isn't Prestwick the only part of the UK that Elvis Presley set foot in? Because he never visited the UK and never performed in the UK. But when he was in the US Army, he was stationed in Germany in the 50s. And he touched the army plane, the US Army plane, touched down at an army base in Prestwick, I think I'm right in saying. And then so he spent, you know, a few hours on the ground there. And then on to Germany and possibly I know that's kind of a celebrated thing about it, but other than that, no. Was it Princess Margaret?
It wasn't, unfortunately, Princess Margaret. But the Elvis link, you are absolutely right. Elvis touched down at Prestwick Airport on the 2nd of March 1916. 60. So only really kind of 19 years later. And again, I think, you know, we were talking a little bit about paradigms and conspiracies and things earlier. There is, I think, some kind of correlation there. There is an Elvis dynamic.
It's an amazing coincidence, isn't it, that two totally unrelated people, only 19 years apart, were in the same place. I mean, that's just, that synchronicity or what? You know, I mean, the mind boggles, James.
It certainly does. So we are talking not about Princess Margaret, as you've hastened to guess. We are talking about Amy Johnson. Okay, we're talking about flying ace Amy Johnson. And we're cutting now, I guess, to what happened to her. Where did she go? Well, it's still unknown, I think it has to be said. So in 1941, on that day I mentioned, the 5th of January, she was flying from Prestwick, but she went off course in what is known as adverse weather. That means terrible weather. Very bad weather conditions, and she also, in battling this, ran out of fuel. Okay, so the plane ran out of fuel. She had no choice. She had to bail out of the aircraft and just jump and see where she landed. We've all done it. It's a difficult thing to do, I think. And the aircraft itself crashed somewhere in the Thames Estuary, apparently just off of Herne Bay, but somewhere in the Thames Estuary, the aircraft was seen going down, and she herself, Amy, was spotted alive in the water. She was seen, her parachute was spotted, and she was seen alive in the water. But this was, again, what they would call a heavy sea. This was a sea that was not very forgiving in terms of people jumping around in it at the time. Obviously, I'm trying to use sort of nautical terms and my maritime knowledge to get this across to you. It's a strong tide, and it was snowing. So it was intensely cold as well. It was a very cold evening. So whether she had a cardigan or not, I don't know. But the HMS Hazelmere went out and attempted to rescue Amy, but she was lost under the ship. Or was she? That's the question, I guess. So not only did HMS Hazelmere go out and try and find her and rescue her, but the captain of HMS Hazelmere was in the water himself trying to rescue her, trying to find her. He couldn't, unfortunately. And days later, he himself died in circumstances relating to basically hypothermia from the water. So he got very cold trying to find her. And I guess this links in some ways to the other icon that we were talking about earlier, because there are a number of unexplained elements, which I like your thoughts on. Okay, so at the time, there was an idea that there was a second body in the water. Now, there are also reports of a shell suit being identified and goalkeeper's gloves, okay, with a Coventry City logo on them. So what do you make of that?
So, I mean, it's obviously some kind of interdimensional double or triple murder. I mean, that's what immediately springs to mind. There is one factual discrepancy. I am not looking at a map, but if I was flying from Prestwick in Scotland to somewhere near Oxford, did you say Kidlington?
Kidlington, yes.
I've never heard of Kidlington, but okay, I've heard of Oxford. Would you go via Herne Bay?
I think one of the key factors is that she got lost. She was off course due to the bad weather.
Quite lost. I see. Okay. I mean, I don't know if you drew a straight line from, or you know, an aeronautical line from Prestwick to Oxford, that it would encompass Herne Bay. I kind of got my doubts about that. I'd have to check the map and see. Okay, well, let's put that inconvenient question to one side. So, plane went down. She jumped out of the plane. The plane went down. She landed in the Thames and possibly drowned, or did she? The captain of the ship came out to rescue her, jumped in the water, and then got back out again, and then he died mysteriously some days later. And I've got a sneaking feeling, James, that you have laid down some false clues in somehow implicating David Icke going back sort of 20 years before he was born, 10 years before he was born to get involved in this scenario. But then that the only way you could rule out David Icke's involvement is if you also rule out time travel. So, you know, I mean, that's a pretty heavy judgment to make. So what's your explanation of what went down?
So there are more unexplained facts, which I think give a little bit more colour as well. So remember, there was a war on at the time, and that's obviously an excuse lots of people use for various misdemeanours. But there's an idea that it was friendly fire, that Johnson herself had been contacted when she got lost and was asked for a code and to give signal coding so that people knew that she was a friendly aircraft, an allied force, if you like. But she incorrectly gave the code twice. So it was assumed that she was actually one of Jerry's men, and she was shot at and shot out of the sky. So, it wasn't just the fuel or the bad weather or anything like that. She was actually shot at. And the theory goes that when they discovered that they had actually blown Amy Johnson Flying Ace out of the sky in an act of military incompetence, there was a cover-up. They tried to cover up the fact with some outrageous suggestions about her being lost under a ship and all of those kind of things, even though she was clearly sighted landing in the water. I suppose the most likely theory is when she was in the water, she was probably slightly unconscious, if you can be slightly unconscious, and unable to really kind of help herself much, and was sucked under the ship into the propellers and made into fish food. Again, we have to be sensitive about some of the facts here, because they are startling. But I think the overwhelming fact here, Dave, is no body was ever recovered. They never found the body at all. Now, whether that, she'd been shredded and cast across a wide area, or whether she did survive, she met Elvis again in 1960 through a portal that David Icke and Marilyn Monroe had conjured up. We don't know that, do we? It's possible. But again, I want to come back to that central question. Is she still alive?
Well, I mean, the absence of a body is pretty conclusive proof that she's still alive, isn't she? I think, I think we could all agree on that. Albeit, as we've already said, she would be approaching 118 years of age, so fairly elderly. I mean, she might even be so elderly now that she may have had to stop flying. But just think, any of us could look up at the sky at any time and see a plane going across and think to ourselves, is that Amy at the helm right now? Now, odds are that it's probably no more than 50% likely that it is her, but you just never know. That's one of those little mysteries I think we'll all have to accept.
I think that is possibly one of the greatest kind of accolades that a person, particularly a person famous for aviation feats like Amy Johnson, could ever wish for. And that was possibly the way that she went.